Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Good day and welcome to the broadcast. I'm Father Matt Malone, Editor-in-Chief of America Magazine.
And I'm Carrie Weber, Executive Editor, and each week we offer you the news and analysis from the intersection of the church and the world, gathered by our team at America Media.
And one of our team is here today in studio. Excited to see him, Father Patty Gilger, who is a contributing editor for Culture at America.
Pleasure to be here with you both.
Today we have a wonderful guest, Damian Costello. He's the author of the book Black Elk, Colonialism and Lakota Catholicism. And he has a PhD in theological studies, and he has done work on Black Elk that's informed by 4.5 years on the reservation, which is the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. And you have also lived there, as we were saying before the break, right, Patty?
I have, yeah.
Because the Jesuits have a real presence on Pine Ridge for a long time.
Yeah, for 120 years or so.
And can you tell us a little bit about the history of the Jesuits there, quickly?
Sure. So we were invited to come out onto the reservation, onto Pine Ridge Reservation, which was originally an Episcopalian reservation. So when the reservations were constructed, shaped by the U.S. government, they were done so in each denomination to prevent competition, was given a reservation. The Episcopalians were given the Pine Ridge Reservation. But Chief Red Cloud, who was one of the great leaders, you know, foundational leaders of the Lakota tribe there, when during the time of the reservation commencement, building, asked the Jesuits to come. So he decided that he really needed a school, and so who were going to come to teach his children, teach the Lakota children there, the Jesuits. So we did. We came out in response to that.
It's a fascinating history, and the school there is still thriving today.
Yeah, actually doing very well. I'm really, really proud of a number of the graduates of Red Cloud that I've taught, that I know really love them. So,
and in fact, folks can check out at americamagazine.org a short documentary film that was done by America Films on a graduation there couple of years ago.
Yeah.
It's really cool. You should check it out.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. So one of the most famous folks to live on that reservation was Black Elk, and you might have heard of him. It's a famous book called Black Elk Speaks. And he was second cousin to Crazy Horse. He was in the Battle of Bighorn. He was only 12 at that time. He became a ghost dancer. He fought in the aftermath of Wounded Knee. But what a lot of people don't know is that he also converted to Catholicism. So here to talk with us about that is Damian Costello. Damian, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon. Great to be with you.
Thanks.
And if I could just add one quick correction. I was not on Pine Ridge. I was actually in the Navajo Reservation.
Oh, I apologize. Oh, very good.
No problem.
I also lived there for a year.
Oh, great. Okay.
So we have a little experience on reservations here, but I think that you have a lot more of the history for us, Damon. So could you tell us a little bit more about who Black Elk was?
Sure. I did a very good job sort of highlighting his iconic biography. You know, I think of any Native Americans, and I think also any historical figure, he has as iconic a biography as you're going to find, because he found himself in such noteworthy events time and time again, whether it was the Battle of Little Bighorn, Wounded Knee. He traveled Europe with Buffalo Bill Cody's Wild West Show for 2 years, very significant part of his life. And he was so able to encapsulate that and tell that story that he became, you know, bigger than life. I mean, he is emblematic. He is symbolic of all this history. And so on the Catholic side, the part that most people don't know, you know, he'd been exploring Christianity for a long time before he converted in 1904. One of the most important parts of his journey was in Europe. You know, his decision to go to Europe with the Wild West Show was part job, part, you know, a young man's adventure, but he very explicitly said, you know what, the white man, they're taking over, they have this power we don't understand, I'm going to go see their world, I'm going to try and figure it out, and if there's anything good, I'm going to bring it back. And so he writes back from Europe that the only thing he's found, you know, he's investigating the horrors of the Industrial Revolution of the late 1800s, he says, the only thing I could find are the white man's customs and teachings about God. So that's the first time he really sort of grasps onto Christianity. So anyway, in 1904, he had this sort of problematic encounter with a Jesuit priest, which we could talk about a little bit more if necessary. He was a holy man, Black Elk. He was at a curing ceremony, and the priest jumped in, stopped the ceremony, and in the aftermath, Black Elk went with the priest to a Holy Rosary mission and converted to Catholicism.
This was a Jesuit priest who was assigned to the reservation?
Yes. Yeah. You know, so the Jesuits, you know, they were great people for the most part, but their greatest conflict was with the medicine men, with their ceremonial practices. And so that was the beginning of his Catholic life, but his Catholic life was sincere, wholehearted, and dynamic. He was a missionary. He became a dynamic preacher, was known for memorizing scripture, and was attributed with 400 conversions. So he's not an average Catholic. He's not somebody, you know, going along with the crowd. This is somebody who became a dynamic leader in the Lakota Catholic Church.
Right. Can you talk a little bit more about that sort of tension between the Catholic Church and the traditional ways of the Lakota? People might have heard of some of the boarding schools that were run by various denominations or the government trying to kind of coach young kids or coerce them into not living out sort of their Lakota ways or their traditional ways and trying to make them more European, perhaps. How much did the church or the Jesuits or the Catholics in that area participate in that? How much of that do you feel was a part of the attempts to convert people at that time? And how much was more of the trying to walk with people toward conversion?
Right. I think there was kind of two things going on. You know, it was a government policy, sort of a nationwide attitude that was seen as an alternative to just extermination. Well, if we can change these people into white people, then we won't have to kill them, basically. We don't really want to kill them. You know, very problematic today. I mean, horrific, but that was seen as like sort of a better alternative. And so the church, in a lot of ways, inherited that as much as it helped promote that. I think they were more inheritors of that. So in boarding schools, they participated in that, and, you know, it was a very troubling record. A lot of people are still recovering from that. I think the most active place, you know, we already mentioned, where the church saw itself as, you know, is it necessary to help people, lead people to conversion, was challenging the religious authority among the Lakota, particularly in the healing ceremonies. And I think that's where you find the most intentional work by the church to challenge traditional Lakota culture and ceremonial life. Right. You know, in a lot of ways, you know, we shouldn't be lost that the church, in a lot of ways, respected much of Lakota tradition and language, right, especially in spheres outside of the schools.
Right. The Franciscans on the Navajo Reservation were some of the first people to write a Navajo dictionary and to get the language down in a written form as well. So there was a sense of wanting to preserve the culture in some capacity sometimes as well.
Yeah, I think that, you know, that should be mentioned and really highlighted. You know, you have these figures like among the Navajo, Father Berard Hale,
right,
you know, the leader in linguistic and anthropological work among ceremonial life too, and among the Lakota too. Like, Jesuits and other missionaries are some of the best sources for Lakota, Navajo, other people trying to get back what remains of their cultural identity and history.
Now, Damien, I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that conflict between the colonialism and the Lakota Catholicism that is, in fact, the subhead of your book. So I'm assuming you can expound upon this somewhat. And about how that that past conflict influences the way in which Lakota Catholics approach the faith and the canonization today.
Well, regarding how Lakota Catholics approach a canonization, my sense was, or is, that know, there's kind of two schools of thought on it. You know, one, you have people who, while embracing the church on some level, seeing it as a positive thing, especially in the context of a lot of societal and family trouble, still not being sure if they can trust the church, right? That, you know, we've been burned a lot in the past. There's been a lot of problems, and we're not sure if the church is really engaging this on a, you know, as a sincere effort from the church. Is this more about the church trying to cover up things from the past? And then I would say the majority of people that I encountered were unequivocally positive about it, who saw it as an affirmation of what they've been living for a long time. You know, it hasn't been easy for Lakota or other natives to be both sincere practicing Catholics and recognized as, you know, fully native in their identity, because it's often seen as a compromise, embracing something that is foreign. So for a lot of Lakota Catholics, my sense was that this is an affirmation of where they've been, and it's going to bring forward this sort of new energy to help them continue to make sense of what does it mean to practice the Lakota way and the Catholic way at the same time without it being a problem or a compromise or a contradiction.
And that is really the challenge that that we have in every culture, isn't it? I mean, how is it that you know, that this faith, which is perennial and universal, instantiates itself in this particular culture, and that must be a very difficult thing to do in a culture that, you know, has this relationship with the country that surrounds it, that, you know, has a dark history.
Exactly. And, you know, a lot of the messages that say, well, you know, this can't happen, aren't things that were inherent to Lakota tradition in the first place. I mean, certainly new ideas are seen initially as foreign, whether they come from other tribes or come from Americans or Europeans. But Lakota and most indigenous cultures absorb new ideas within the framework with which they live and practice and see the world. It's not natural to divide things up and to see them in opposition. And so, you know, what I argue is that Black Elk, you know, a lot of these contradictions for somebody of his traditional background and experience wouldn't have encountered these contradictions. You know, these are contradictions that came with later generations that needed to be worked out.
Right. And what is the current status of his cause?
The current status is, so Bishop Groos proclaimed him that he's putting the process forward. So I believe he's now referred to as servant of God. This now moves to the USCCB, and there'll be a voice vote about it. I've been told, like, that this never is a problem if it's brought forward from a local diocese.
Right.
And, you know, there's support. It's universally approved. To move to the Vatican, and this long process of vetting occurs. The local postulator, Lakota man Bill White, will be leading the work to look at all Black Elk's writings, everything that was attributed to him, getting oral testimony, if there's anybody out there who still remembers him, to make sure that there's nothing out there we don't know about. And the Vatican will look at that, and if they approve, then he will be proclaimed venerable. And then we wait for miracles, right? There's one to get to blessed, and then one for sainthood.
Right. And, so, and Black Elk's family is involved in the cause, right? His descendants?
Yes. So his George Looks Twice is the sort of patriarch of that family. There's a lot of relatives.
That is just the most wonderful name.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
A great name.
Which made for a very great lead in your article.
Oh, thank you. Most of his support, or I should say most of his ancestors are supportive, but there is a side of the family that is a little more wary of the process.
Mm-hmm.
That should be recognized as well.
Right, right, yeah.
Damien, how did speaking of the negotiations of contemporary indigenous identity and Catholic identities again, what did you notice the like people on the reservation on Pine Ridge, how did they negotiate some of those tensions themselves? Did they talk to you about that at all or share any of their own concerns or struggles with it, desires?
You know, when you show up in a reservation situation, which, you know, two of you know firsthand, these are not kind of conversations that are generally the first thing that people like to talk about.
That's true.
But they were more open than I expected, coming from my own situation out west in the Navajo Reservation, particularly some of the elders, Basil Braveheart, the man behind the movement to change Harney Peak in the Black Hills to Blackhawk Peak. He was very, very open about his both troubling experience in the boarding school at Holy Rosary Mission, but also his commitment and engagement with Catholic life. You know, he's there most days at daily mass. He's talking about Jesus all the time and trying to figure out, how does this work with my Lakota tradition? It's just a process of, you know, of a struggle. You know, people, it's very much out in the open. You know, it's probably one of the most prominent social conversations that's being had, at least among Catholic circles.
Right. When I was on the Navajo Reservation, there were a lot of people who were very involved in the Catholic Church and the Catholic faith, and then who were also very involved in their traditional ways, and often saw them as a way to pray to God, right? To our the Holy Trinity, you know, to God in the way that Catholics see God, but just in a very different capacity, and to try to meld those things together. And often the church would do their best to incorporate, you know, burning of sage instead of incense, or then every other week the mass was in Navajo. And so they would be chanting the Hail Mary instead of, you know, singing a version of this, or and it was fascinating for me to learn about the ways that these two things were connected, and the lines that people had drawn for themselves and for their communities.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, as outsiders, it's difficult for us to see, you know, there's obviously struggle and pain and all of those things, but it also lends to a certain vibrancy that you don't encounter in a situation where there isn't struggle. Not to say that struggle is good, but, you know, there was one volunteer who's at the school right now, Red Cloud School. He had been a volunteer as a guy right out of college. His wife went too, and then came back east, you know, and his kids were young, and then he went back, and he was talking about his story, and he's like, you know, Damien, where else can you go where you're talking about God all the time? And it's true. These questions, these struggles, these vibrant cultures, both Lakota and Catholic or whatever native culture you're in, lend a very vibrant conversation and communal life, even if it doesn't always worked out in its final form. And I think that's one thing that should be highlighted. This isn't just, you know, struggle and darkness and gloom.
Right.
There is that, but, you know, you go to a mass in, you know, Pine Ridge or the Navajo Reservation, you're going to be, your faith is going to be challenged and enriched in a way that will surprise you.
Yeah. What is the part of Black Elk's story that touches you most powerfully?
Well, I guess I would say there's two things going on with him. You know, on the one hand, I think for a lot of people who, you know, who are more traditional Catholics or might describe themselves as conservative, however you want to say that, there might be the suspicion, like, all right, is this sort of a PC move, right? Do we have to find the next Native person because there's not enough? And both the readings are being out there. I mean, that's not what's going on here. This was a incredibly vibrant, committed person, both in his early Native Lakota traditions, but then as he became Catholic. And the witness of his life is, I think, very beautiful, very powerful, especially since he was learning and embracing the faith in a very, very difficult condition.
Right, a conversion that came out of a confrontation, really.
Exactly, like, yeah. You know, the whole society collapsing around you and trying to rediscover what it is, how to go forward. And so then the second more surprising thing, you know, and this is more in my book than the article, is that, you know, I really think that it was this new faith in Jesus Christ, was this new power that really helped to explain what was happening. So on the one sense, it provided this framework of justice that held American society and Euro-Americans accountable, right? What happened is not okay. And there is a bigger power that is looking out for us and will judge this whole situation. You know, sort of, I guess you'd say, a social justice kind of thrust. But on the other hand, he also really struggled and was trying to figure out what do we do with these new people, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, most tribal peoples don't think of people outside of their tribe as fully human, and the Lakota were no different. And this new faith, this new love, you know, what he wrote about in Europe was what helped him to see these new people as fully human and deserving of love and making sense of this whole new situation. So, you know, Bishop Gruss in his homily talked about him, Black Elk, being a bridge builder. And I really think, you know, at the very heart of his very dynamic and innovative theology, that's what he's talking about. You know, these big things, colonialism, conquest, all these different things at the heart, you know, the bridge that is built and helps make sense of this all is this message of love, this new power that Jesus, you know, the Lakota say, Wanikia, he who makes live,
right,
comes to us.
Right, exactly. And I mean, ultimately, the faith is only as powerful as it's represented as connected to its intrinsic strength, which is the power of love, right?
Yeah.
And that's the only thing that makes it credible and believable. The piece is called Black Elk, the Lakota medicine man turned Catholic teacher is promoted for sainthood. And you can find that at americamagazine.org. The author is Damien Costello, along with John M. Sweeney. You also might check out his book, Black Elk, Colonialism and Lakota Catholicism. Damien, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
All right. Take care. Really interesting story, and how appropriate that we'd be talking today about a possible canonization or cause for sainthood on the Feast of All Saints.
Indeed it is. It's I know the saints are not your favorite topic, right? But
whoever said that? I said I wasn't one. So.
It's always wonderful to hear about, you know, holy men and women who are such good examples to us.
Yeah, listening to Damien is really a joy for me, bringing me back to some of those experiences I had in my 3 years out there on Pine Ridge working at Red Cloud. And one of the things that he brought up for me again was his great memories of what the Lakota traditional spirituality gave me as a practicing Catholic. And one of the many things to talk about, but one of the best things was their deep lived sense of humility. So for example, in their traditional ceremonies, when they are praying, almost always the prayer will be out loud, and they will begin their prayer with the people furthest away from them, and then from the furthest away stretch back and back and back and back and back until the last prayer, well, they will say, and finally I ask you for something for myself.
Right.
It's fantastic. And so just to try to imitate that for me in my own life as a priest, it's really the way I want to try to be with the people of God, you know, with the
right.
church.
It's starting with the margins, as Pope Francis talks about.
And I was also reminded of what we were talking about at the top of the hour when we were talking about how to approach this secularism that we have in contemporary American society. And whenever we're encountering a new culture or a new cultural force, the first basic human instinct is to be afraid, mm-hmm. and that is what we have to always be mindful of, and ultimately can only be overcome by faith. So you've been listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. To learn more about all of the topics that we talked about today, you can check out americamagazine.org. You can also follow us on Twitter and on Facebook. And to subscribe to America, call 1-800-627-9533. That's 1-800-627-9533 for a smart Catholic take on faith and culture. For Father Patty Gilger and Carrie Weber, I'm Father Matt Malone. Thank you and good day.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.